Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on Monday, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on today's program, a look at thetrumpet.com, a couple of other headlines, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Interesting note for this day in history related to technology, I think you'll find quite interesting. And also, we're going to be taking a look this week at a tremendous booklet, Conspiracy Against Fatherhood, very relevant for the headlines that we're seeing all over the place today. We're going to take a look at that and more in this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We are online, too, at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, please do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today. And how you feeling? You rested? You ready for the week after a nice weekend?
I feel amazing.
Great. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, we had a little busier weekend. We had a little family trip that we did, and a little bit of driving. So, but not too bad. It was nice out on the interstates, nice and clear. I'm always amazed, and I think we take it for granted here in the U.S. But how many places you can go and there's just beautifully paved interstates? Mm. You know, even though there's road construction occasionally, very rarely do you hit a spot where it's you know uncomfortable, let alone impassable.
Yeah, some states do get more federal funding for their roads than others, but just in general, the level is very high compared to anywhere else.
I talked to a fellow years ago. I always remember this. I think he was somewhere from Africa originally. And I asked him, I said, what's the biggest difference that you see between the U.S. and where you're from? And he said, roads. Mm. And that always stuck with me because we can get places. Semis can deliver things. You know, if you think, boy, if we didn't have a road, what would we do? We wouldn't go there. So I'm always I'm impressed with how many roadways we have here in the U.S. So enjoyed those yesterday, as much as you can enjoy them by driving.
Right.
But it was good. We were talking the other day or the other week about the phenomenon known as pumpkin spice flavoring. It turns out that even though it's a big thing and people really like it, a new taste sensation is challenging the pumpkin spice. People are getting a little spiced out. It happened to the Spice Girls. just had to tie that in. The pumpkin spices, people are getting a little bit sick of it. So there's a new flavor coming out, and it is maple syrup. That's the new flavor. There's a new maple syrup latte, apparently, or a maple flavor, I guess, maybe a better way to say it. Maple latte. They're putting maple in all kinds of things, including whiskey. On and on and on it goes. So that's the new flavor of the month.
I've actually been noticing that a lot more than pumpkin spice lately, maple flavored cookies and whatnot. After a while, you have to have some variety and not just always have the same exact seasonal flavor.
They say maple based treats are getting hotter and hotter. Industry analyst Technomic reports that sales of maple flavored non alcoholic beverages are up nearly 85% since 2016. So, for those that are selling that flavoring, that's good business for them. When I went to grade school, I actually went to Maple Grove Elementary School.
Oh, really?
That's what it was called, and it was in a grove of maple trees. And one of our assignments when we were kids, I guess, was to go out and make maple syrup when we were like in first grade. You'd learn the process, and so you know you put the bucket on the tree and you tap the tree and the sap comes out, and you get a lot of it, and then you gotta boil it down. You don't have as much syrup left. But across the road, they had like a big kind of farm that did it, and they ran plastic tubes between all the trees, so it would just drain naturally down. So it was a lot better way to do it. But the squirrels started chewing through it and drinking,
no,
using them like a straw. So they were stealing the sap from them.
That does seem actually like a really fun project to be involved with, especially as a child. So that's a pretty good way to start off your schooling career as well to be able to do projects like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have animals just always getting in the way. I mean, we just need to get rid of the animals, I guess.
We had to make maple syrup and then learn to square dance and then write a story about maple trees and then draw pictures related to them. And then at the end of the year, our parents would come. They would eat pancakes with the syrup we made, and we would square dance for them.
Oh, that's fun. So,
that was Maple Grove Elementary School circa 1987.
Wow. That's,
I don't know if people do stuff like that anymore, but it was kind of neat.
That's the life. That's way better than anything I ever did at school.
we were ahead of the craze here with the maple syrup flavorings. Here's some of the headlines today from thetrumpet.com. You want to stop and check these out. Deadly 7.3 magnitude earthquake rattles Iran-Iraq border. The massive quake killed hundreds of people and injured multiple thousands. So not a good situation over there. I always assume that it's partially because the construction is just not great. Mm. And so when you have those big earthquakes, there's usually a high fatality count.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of the argument today is that if you're drilling for oil a lot in certain places, that's causing it too. I'm not sure how true that is, but of course, a lot of oil over there too.
That's a great point. Yeah, I mean, I guess... Yeah, that's interesting to think about. But they always seem to have earthquakes over in those areas. I think they felt it all the way up into Turkey and other places like that. Related to that top story is Shaken, Why the Nepal Earthquake Happened, and Why Natural Disasters. So check out those stories there at thetrumpet.com today. Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Make sure you check that out. Lots of topics today. One of them, he mentioned... something, and it's from, I think, the Wall Street Journal here, and the title is this: This Sunday, some churchgoers may choose to pack guns with their Bibles, you know, in response to the shooting two weekends ago. Yeah, that's quite an interesting thought, huh, going to church and bringing a gun with you?
Yeah, I guess that would be the response if you didn't have any other physical means of protecting yourself, and if that was the one way you thought was possible. I mean, obviously, God protects, but he only protects if you're obeying him. So
yep.
The next best way is to bring a gun.
I can't imagine what people like that's just such a strange meeting of different sort of ideas. Like
yeah.
Here you're going to, as they would see it, worship God, and yet they're potentially carrying weapons in case it comes to that. So what a strange mix of, I guess, just different facets of life.
Yeah, and it just shows you the sad reality today that those things are happening a lot.
A little bit of this write-up, it says, as he does every Sunday, and it gives the name of the gentleman, he's an Anglican rector, put on his collar and robes to offer Mass at his Central Pennsylvania church. It says, now he is considering wearing something else with his religious vestments, his handgun. As a Pennsylvania state constable, Dr. Ned is his name, can bring his gun just about everywhere, to the grocery store, to the park, and to synagogues and other houses of worship, where he often acts as security. His church was the one place where he went unarmed. He said weapons do not belong in church, but he said he has a responsibility to protect the flock. And he said he didn't bring his weapon to church this Sunday, but he plans to in the future. And it just made me think of Jeremiah 17:5, where it says, thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Lord. So if you're putting your trust into physical protection of some kind in that way, I think there might be something to think about there. I mean, especially when you're going to church, you'd be wanting to put your trust in God, not necessarily in your arm attached to a gun or somebody else's.
Yeah, that does show that there is a lack of faith in pretty much every church in the entire world. I mean, this has been happening in the Middle East as well. Churches are an easy target because they're supposed to be places of peace, places where people go to maybe free their minds of other worries and concerns. They're not trying to think of those harsh realities sometimes, and yet this is what's seemingly taking place more and more all the time. And so if you were just a regular person out in the world, that would totally make sense to carry a gun with you pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point you bring up. I thought, in kind of looking at this story, one of the first things I thought about was some of those bigger religious ceremonies you'll see in other countries where bombs go off. And, you know, they might have a religious experience as they view it, or they might end up dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of the way that it goes in some of those things. So it's going to be like that a little bit here, I guess, as well. It makes me also think of like the Wild West.
Yeah.
You know, everyone just carrying guns on their belts and things, and just an interesting thing. So anyway, there's no good answers there, and that's pointed out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's just, if you take God out of the equation, there's no good answers. More guns, less guns, more this, more that. No matter what they try, there's always problems that pop up.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that the left's response is to take away all the guns. That actually goes counter to the natural human response to situations like this, where people don't want to be made victims, and so they try to protect themselves. The left is trying to say that if we all got rid of the guns, that none of these things would happen anymore. Although it seems like anyone who's going to go shoot up a church probably wouldn't be deterred by a law against them having a gun.
Yeah, and that, the difficulty with, say, saying you're going to get rid of all guns is that, first of all, not everybody's going to, so that it's not going to happen. Secondly, even if you didn't have those, people would start arming themselves with other things. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, if you've ever seen anything in the news or seen any of those shows about prisons, other than the security guards, nobody has guns. The criminals find every which way to make a weapon to use out of anything they can find, and so ultimately the problem is with man and his thinking, and then, you know, whether whatever he uses, if he has an evil motive, he's going to find something. And so until you solve that evil human nature and Satan's influence, you're not going to solve the problem.
Right. I mean, it's the equivalent of blaming cars and trying to take away cars every time there's a car crash that kills someone, or every time a plane gets hijacked and brought down on purpose, even. It's like saying we need to get rid of planes. I mean, none of those arguments make any sense, but for some reason with guns, that's the common argument.
So you will see what develops there, but that's something even now churchgoers are thinking about. That's from the Wall Street Journal. This Sunday, some churchgoers may choose to pack guns with their Bibles. You know, it's just interesting. That's, you look at America's Sunday these days, right? Some people will go to church on that day, and now they're thinking about taking guns. And then after that, they have football games where, you know, some people won't stand, some people will stand, there's protesting. Like, everything is, there's so much conflict in everything that's happening on the American weekend, which used to be a time of relaxation, and now it seems like it's more tense than any of the other days of the week.
Yeah, we've come to a place where it's now 7 days of stress. There's no escape, no matter where we turn. And I think that a lot of that just shows that there is really only one way of escape, and that's with God, and people just need to take the time to consider that option, which is usually everybody's last option.
Yeah, and you got to consider, you know, what day you go to church as well. That's also important. Here's something interesting that happened on this day in history, November the 13th. This is a technology note, and I thought you'd find it interesting. In 2006, a deal was finalized for Google Incorporated to acquire YouTube for $1.65 million in Google stock. So only $1.65 million. You're asking yourself, how much is YouTube worth today? Well, best guess is, CNBC said, they had a commentator on there, said, if YouTube were a stock, it would be worth $75 billion today. $1.65 million. Now YouTube supposedly could be worth up to $75 billion. And it all started with funny cat videos, and look where it's gone.
Yeah, I guess that might be why it was valued so low at first, but obviously you can almost change the world by the content that you put on YouTube now, and so of course it's going to be valued a lot higher. There are a lot of deals like that where people are smart and they're able to get in early, and then they just basically watch their venture explode after they've bought it.
Yeah, what's that old saying? Money makes money.
Mm.
So you got to have money to get in the game, and they chose right on YouTube. And approximately 20% of the people who start your video will leave after the first 10 seconds. So that's the great thing about YouTube is you can reach everybody, but the bad thing is everybody can also put their content up there. So there's so much stuff, and most people are leaving, you know, very quickly. I suppose, you know, if you know what you're looking for, you'll stick around. Like, I usually know what I want to watch, so I watch it. But if it's some random video, yeah, I usually get out of it.
Yeah, and a lot of, on most screens as well, you can't see the whole title of the video until you actually click on it, and then I realize, oh, I don't care about this this video once I know what the actual title is and not what the first few words are. So I end up leaving a lot of videos just once I know what the title is.
There's 300 hours of video uploaded every minute to YouTube. It's just everything you can think of is up there. And so it's amazing to see how that's exploded. I mean, I obviously remember pre-YouTube. But for you, it's always kind of been a presence, has on some level.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't really remember when YouTube didn't exist.
It's there was a time, believe it or not. So it's amazing to think about how much video is uploaded. There's a lot of valuable things up there, and there's a lot of worthless things as well. YouTube, of course, now is trying to offer a paid service. They're trying to get into the streaming and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see where they go from here. But if you knew back in 2006 that it'd be worth so much, that $1.65 million investment isn't bad. And it was they bought it with Google stock. So I don't know what that stock's worth today. It's probably worth a fair bit too. But interesting. The related headlines to that from today: world's top tech giants amass $1.7 trillion in monster year. So they made a lot of money. And that eclipses Canada's economy. So I don't know if that's good news for Canada or bad news, but anyway, it gives you an idea of how much money has been made by some of the top tech giants this year.
Yeah, that's right. And it does show you the value of resourcefulness and creativity. And there are just a lot of open doors out there, a lot of opportunities. And I actually saw a video the other day of someone trying to dissuade people from following their passions and just going toward where the opportunities are, because some people, even if you don't care that much about tech, there are a lot of opportunities there that people could exploit.
It's an interesting industry for sure. But it's one of those things too where it doesn't seem to have like a real natural value to it. You can't eat it. You know,
right.
I mean, at some point it's like, well, YouTube's entertaining. It's got some interesting information. Do I absolutely need it for life? Probably not.
I'd be fine throwing it out the window, although it would be hard to, I guess.
Yeah. Yes. Throw YouTube right out that window there. It's interesting to see some of those numbers. Amazing how much people upload and watch those videos every day. And it'd be interesting, too, to even think about how much time people spend watching videos and then, you know, the value you get back from that. We always think about time management and that type of thing. And you'd almost hate to see a printout of the time you've spent doing things in your life. It's like, oh no, how did I spend so much time watching YouTube videos?
Yeah, YouTube can definitely be a black hole, especially if you just start by watching like a 5-minute video or less, and then you're like, well, I only spent 5 minutes. I can always click on the next one. And now they have it where they're automatically loading the next video unless you click cancel. So another video is going to come up on the screen. It's like they're building it for you to binge watch it.
Yeah, they have the related ones that always catch your eye on the side there as well. But you can watch The Key of David online at YouTube or at thetrumpet.com and the Trumpet Daily program as well, and other trumpet videos that are there. So there is some value to it. But once you find what you like, then hopefully you can stay within that realm because there are some odd things out there for sure. You ever put a video on YouTube, like personally? That you would admit to?
Yeah, a couple times. One of my friends got hit in the face with a softball. Like, he was catching behind home plate, and someone foul tipped it right into his face. And so, yeah, I uploaded that.
Is he okay?
Yeah, he's fine.
Did you get a lot of views?
Actually, a lot more than I was expecting. Yeah. Not very many. I mean, it was like only a couple hundred, but
right.
Still.
Well, there are people now that just make their living, their livelihood, their fame on just being on YouTube and just doing things, usually things without a lot of value to them. And some people have gotten in trouble because they kind of put their whole family on YouTube, their whole day-to-day life, and sometimes that's not a good idea, especially when children are involved.
Mm-hmm.
So people have gotten in trouble for that. And then even in the most recent, or one of the most recent Time magazines, they had a list of the most influential teens in the world. And there's two twin brothers. I've never heard of them before. I guess they're really popular. And they're just on YouTube doing kind of silly stunts, but they have this huge following.
Yeah, I saw that same issue, and I was surprised just hearing it. hearing how popular you can get, like he pierced his tongue because he lost some bet with his brother, and he filmed it and put it on YouTube, and it has over 2 million views. But that's just the kind of content that is pretty popular. It's lighter stuff. It's easier to watch it. You don't have to think too much. And so it's you could easily see how people like that could get pretty popular.
It's the reality shows. People are just making their own reality shows. And for some reason, that's interesting to people. They want to look into their lives. And I think everyone knows that it's like kind of a waste of time and silly, but yet it really is captivating. They just keep making more of these reality shows, and people just keep watching them.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of those YouTube stars are really good at forming a connection with their audience, and they seem like they thank their viewers in every video, and they're always trying to offer different gifts and such. And so people, especially, you know, if you're kind of a recluse and you just spend a lot of time on there, you could be like, well, this is my real life friend almost.
Yeah, it can almost get that way. I like to watch some NBA highlights. They have different channels now where they've done a real smart thing, and they just show you like pretty much each made basket or big play. You can watch like the whole game in 9 minutes. And so if it's a team I like, I might watch those if I got some time. And so there's one channel I used to go to, and then somebody else claim to be that person, and they keep having this back and forth like, no, I'm the real one, he's the fake one. I don't care. I just, as long as I can see the content, I don't care who's doing it. But there's this battle of like YouTube identities now, so there's this whole subculture happening.
Yeah, I've seen what you're talking about there. I could imagine why the first person would be really frustrated. Like, you're stealing his name and you're stealing his hundreds of thousands of views because you're just piggybacking off of what he's already done.
Yeah, and of course there can be a revenue stream there. People can actually make pretty good money doing it if they get popular. So that's why people are always begging for for viewers, because they want to be able to make some money on it. So kind of interesting. It was this day in history, November 13th. In 2006, not too long ago, a deal was finalized for Google Incorporated to acquire YouTube for $1.65 million in Google stock. And now, of course, YouTube is estimated to be worth $75 billion. So pretty fascinating. You're listening to Trump Radio Live here Monday on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. And we want to talk about a booklet this week, a really interesting booklet, especially for the times in which we are in. And it has to do with fatherhood, the Conspiracy Against Fatherhood. Conspiracy Against Fatherhood is the title of it. And you can find it for free there at thetrumpet.com. And it's not super long, but there's a lot of great information in there. So we want to take a look at it this week. And the reason that it's so prevalent now, I guess, or it's so relevant, is because of the prevalence of this idea of this toxic masculinity. And that has a lot to do with fatherhood as well. And there's the idea out there that there's something wrong with men. And that's making all the headlines today.
Yeah, and you see in this booklet, this was written over a decade ago, I believe. And so it just shows how quickly, actually almost two decades ago it was written. So it just shows you how quickly you can devolve from questioning if fathers are relevant in the home to now saying, actually, all men are potential sexual predators. And so men in general, not just the fathers, but men in general need to be questioned. And really, we need to look at if they have a place in society.
Right. And it's gaining momentum, that type of thinking. I looked up this. There's this article here that's just got some really interesting thoughts in it. It's worth looking at just to kind of set the stage here. And it's from the Society for General Psychology. So they have their papers they write up. And this author happens to be a man, a father, I guess, in his own right. And he, you know, says that he stays at home and, you know, takes care of the kids and does all these things. So he's really, really into that and trying to, I guess, think about the roles of men. Anyway, the title of the article that he wrote is Toxic Fatherhood, Hypothesis and Hope. So he's taking it not just from the toxic masculinity, it's toxic fatherhood now. And he says, to preserve his manhood, a man must either be violent within the domestic sphere or absent from it. So his whole idea is that in traditional masculinity, as he would see it, or fatherhood, in order to maintain this idea of fatherhood, they either had to be violent or just aloof, like there was nothing in the middle. And how many people have had just wonderful fathers that have not been anything like that? But this guy is trying to brand all fatherhood in that horrible sort of characterization.
Yeah, and from what it sounds like, it's probably just to excuse his own failings in that area, because he's obviously got the roles flipped upside down and he doesn't understand how to be a father himself. And so he just presents this gigantic logical fallacy of the two extremes. And like you say, there are so many examples of how that's not true, but people will read that and they will say, well, yeah, maybe this guy is right. It's just extremely deceptive.
He bases his thinking on like a commercial that he saw and something else, and it's not worth really getting into because you really have to stretch your mind, and not in a good way, to try to get what he's talking about. he was dissecting a truck commercial and trying to say, well, you know, this part of the commercial means this and this means, I think they're just trying to sell a truck, but he's trying to say that it's somehow, you know, indicative of toxic fatherhood and so forth. So anyway, leave that to the listeners if they so care to read it. But he goes at the end and he looks at different sources of information and says, well, this is kind of where this idea of toxic fatherhood or traditional fatherhood, I guess you'd call it, comes from. And he has a illustration from the Bible. He says, Abraham waits all his life for a son whom the Lord has promised him. When he finally becomes a father, God tests him by ordering him to kill his son. Abraham obeys, but at the moment he raises his arm to strike, an angel stops him, and the Lord declares him himself pleased. This idea that the death of the son is bound up in a proof of faith later finds expression in a core doctrine of many forms of Christianity, that Jesus had to die to appease a heavenly father who is angry at the sins of humanity. He's off on that quite a bit.
Yeah, and that really does show some more hypocrisy, because we have a culture that is obsessed with death of our babies before they're even born. And So what is he talking about? I mean, in that case of Abraham, he never even had to kill his son. In the case of the other one, there was a death that paid for the sins of all mankind. It wasn't just for no reason. Did he conveniently leave out the part that it paid for all people so that all people wouldn't have to die forever?
Right. He did conveniently leave that out. You know, years ago, if you went to a sports stadium or you watched something on TV, you'd see people holding the sign for John 3:16. I don't know that you see that anymore, but back in the day you used to. And if you keep reading there, 3:16 through 17, it says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." That's the part he left out, that whole part.
Right. He gave his Son. He didn't just kill him out of his own sick pleasures. And so that's just, it's a totally different way of viewing it, but I guess people could twist it if they wanted to.
And it, I think it highlights why this particular author and people that would follow that type of thinking are off on the truth of what biblical fatherhood is, because they don't understand God the Father. They have no, they see it as this angry God who's angry at people for making mistakes and sinning, and so, you know, he'll kill his son because somebody's got to die. And that he didn't do it for that. He did it to, you know, because a price has to be paid for broken law, but he did it out of love. Both of them, the Father and the Son, did it out of love to bring all people into God's kingdom. Not hate, absolute love there.
Yeah, and why would he kill his eternal companion who had done nothing but dwell with him in peace for all eternity? So it just, none of that reasoning makes any sense. You would think that God would take it out on the entire human race. He did wipe out the earth with a flood, but then he promised it would never happen again. And even those wiped out in the flood, everyone who has ever died will have another chance. That's what this author is leaving out.
And that's why an article like this, or just the whole idea of, say, the toxic masculinity or toxic fatherhood in this case, why it's so off base is because the whole article spends time dissecting a truck commercial, and it doesn't spend hardly any time looking at the Word of God. And when it mentions that, it doesn't have any understanding about what it's about. That's why they're off.
Yeah, and it just frames the Bible unfairly and moves on, as if that settles the entire discussion. Fathers historically even look in the Bible, have to be appeased by killing their sons, and then he moves on.
Right. And so just a really, really bizarre thinking there. But again, that's it might be, he might be a little bit on the extreme side. I don't know that everybody would feel like him, but that thinking is definitely out there. So that leads us into this just great book, Conspiracy Against Fatherhood. And in the beginning, it says, "We hear a great deal about conspiracies today. Our people almost seem conspiracy obsessed, but the greatest and most damaging conspiracy is the one against fatherhood today. And very few people understand it or what deadly consequences it will have on our society. You get rid of the father, what do you do to the society? I think the numbers are out there. People know it's bad.
It is really bad, and yet people are trying to actually blame the nuclear family itself. They're trying to say that the traditional family structure is the cause of the problems, as if the traditional family is then going out to non-traditional families and oppressing them. That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah, the blaming the stable institution for problems when destroying it's what's causing the problems. It says here in the beginning, fathers beware. And it says Kathleen Parker wrote in the Sunday Oklahoman on July 25th, 1999. Seems like ancient history now. It's got a lot worse since then, but back in 1999, it says now is the time for all good fathers to come to the aid of the family. Hurry, she says, your days are numbered. If you happen to be a heterosexual male, further doomed by Caucasian pigmentation, in other words, you're white, your days are already over, according to a cover article in the June issue of American Psychologist. That's proven to be true, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it has gotten even worse, the way that people demand that the father leave the home or demand that... you know, just the talk of grievance today and paying reparations to people, and we have to dismantle our own families for the good of everyone else. I mean, there have been people saying those types of things now, and it's a lot more extreme, but here's an example of how it started. Simply a psychological association questioning if fathers are relevant. Now it's people demanding that fathers step down from their role.
Yeah, that's a lot of times the way it goes, isn't it? Throw out a question or an idea, and then it gains speed and traction, and then all of a sudden it's a demand, you know. And it continues in this article, and it says, in their article, Deconstruction of the Essential Father, researchers Louis B. Silverstein and Carl F. Auerbach challenge one of the core institutions of our culture, fatherhood. More or less, fathers, as we've known and loved them, are obsolete. The article makes numerous breathtaking assertions, but basically the researchers said that fathers aren't essential to the well-being of children, gay, lesbian, and single parents are as good as any other, and heterosexual marriage isn't necessary to produce healthy, well-adjusted children. And so those are ideas that are out there. I think they're still prominent ideas, even though the numbers do show that that's absolutely false.
Right, and it's the numbers, the stats, the facts of the situation totally contradict what people want to be true, and yet people just will not have that. They have to go by emotion, maybe by personal experience. Maybe people know a homosexual couple that seems to have happy children, and they're like, well, look, in this case, it seems like they're doing just fine. And that's how they base their entire opinion, instead of looking at the statistics and looking at where those children end up whenever they're not raised in the right type of home environment.
Yeah, I mean, even this the article that we quoted in the beginning, which was from a few months ago about this toxic fatherhood, even he had to admit that, well, the numbers do show that if the father's not around, there's more problems. He had to throw that in there, but then he said, well, but, you know. So in his whole hypothesis there in the beginning is from the Society for General Psychology. You know, he wasn't really saying, well, we shouldn't have fatherhood, but he was saying fathers should be mothers. We should just have a lot of motherhood. He's not opposed to a guy being there, but you got to kind of be more like a mom than a dad.
And that's what it sounded like that other author was saying about how he was staying home and how he thought the truck commercial was trying to present certain messages. It's almost like you have to totally take away all of your masculinity and then stay in the home as basically a transitioned female.
Yeah, and it's that's the idea today, and they have other assertions here again in this article that's being quoted in Conspiracy Against Fatherhood, that, you know, the homosexuals, they're just, it's fine, they can raise the kids, a single parent's good, just fine, and that's as good as any other thing, and that the marriage wasn't necessary, and so that's the way society's going. And in the book, it says, I agree wholeheartedly with Kathleen Parker's condemnation of the APA article, except for one statement. She called fatherhood one of the core institutions of our culture. It says, I want to show you why it is the core institution of our society. So we're going to see that as we go through this booklet. It's not a small thing to get rid of. It's like saying, you know, just cut your head off, but the rest of your body will be fine and carry on. You can't do that.
Yeah, and like I said, people will point to maybe rare exceptions where people growing up in a non-traditional family end up being a success, probably in spite of the family arrangement, if we're being honest. And then maybe sometimes those who grow up in a good family don't turn out a success. I mean, you can't necessarily force your children to follow in your footsteps, but... If the facts are that children who grow up in a traditional family are four times more likely, for example, to go through and graduate college, or four times less likely to get involved in criminal behavior, you should probably side with the statistics. I mean, the likelihood of raising successful children should probably make us consider the traditional family the top priority.
Well, that's what's so interesting is that whether it be, say, the scientific community or somebody that has a hypothesis about families, you know, that they're all about the science, they're all about the numbers until they don't agree with the argument, and then they choose to get rid of some numbers or not look at some numbers or not look at some data. And that's what we see here with these arguments for these families or the destruction of the family. They don't look at the numbers. They ignore them because it doesn't support their argument.
And we have started to see that recently in the scientific field. It's been that way for a while regarding evolution. People seeing that evolution is implausible, but they stick with it because their academic careers depend on it. But in a lot of these other fields, it's been a more recent phenomenon where people have an ideology and they have to stick to it. And so even though their entire job, their entire career is based on examining the stats, they're going to go against those stats anytime it contradicts their ideology. That hasn't always been that way, but science now is being totally discredited because everyone has their own preconceived notions that they have to stick to no matter what.
Yeah, and it's the media is interesting because whatever they choose to highlight seems like it's the big issue of the day. Now, so the sexual harassment and so forth and the toxic masculinity, as they call it, is the big highlight of the day. But any of their pet groups, they don't report as vigorously on the assaults in those groups mm-hmm. or the problems in those groups. And you can find them if you look in some of those groups, but they protect it and they don't want to highlight it because it's something they're supporting.
Yeah, and like I mentioned earlier, there was a church shooting recently, but this time it was a black man shooting up a white church instead of a white man shooting up a black church, and you hardly hear nearly as much about it, or maybe if you do hear about it, it's sort of swept away faster because, remember, the white group, especially the white male group, is the evil one, and so that you have to expose anything that they do wrong while hiding what these other groups do. And we've talked about it before. That just shows how they value different people differently. I mean, every life is a life. Every human being is a human being, and we all have the same potential and the same dignity. And yet, we have a media now that tries to favor certain groups over others. You can see why there's such division created from that.
Yeah, lots of division for sure. There is, as you look at just some of the numbers, there is a conspiracy to destroy the traditional family, the biblical family, and attack fatherhood. Just some numbers from census.gov of marriage and family. And you can just see how things have changed over the years. The median age now when adults first marry continues to rise. People are getting older. In 2016, men were about almost 30 and women were about 28. That used to be about 24 and 20 back in 1947. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily better or worse, but people in general are delaying marriage if they do it at all, and less are marrying. And so you can see that people want to do a lot in life before marriage. Marriage is kind of like, it's not looked at in the same way that it used to be.
Right. And those stats, if we really look into them and we examine it case by case, which in a lot of cases it is possible to do that, what we often end up seeing is that people are not waiting to have sex until marriage. They're not waiting to get into a long-term relationship or start cohabiting. They're just waiting for the marriage part. And so is marriage becoming obsolete? Obsolete if all it means is that you've been together for 12 or 15 years and now you finally decide to have the official ceremony. If nothing at all changes except for maybe your last name, is that really a valuable institution anymore? It would seem not, and that's really destructive as well.
That's a really good point. Yeah, the the excitement of getting married seems to not be the same when really nothing changes, as you mentioned. Also, some other numbers here. In 2016, almost one-third of all adults, 32%, have never been married, up from about one-quarter in 1950. So a lot more people not getting married and choosing to go it on their own. What was the term for that? You had a term for that the other day.
Men going their own way. It's some sort of like series of YouTube videos that I stumbled across, and really the men are pretty hateful. Like they're really, really, really upset at women who they believe are just looking to take advantage of them.
More division, as you mentioned. Says of the 11 million families with children under the age of 18 and no spouse present, the majority are single mothers. 8.5 million, so there's a growing number of those. Single fathers comprise about 2.5 million. Married couples make up 68% of all families with children still under the age of 18, but in 1950 that was 93%, and we're at 68% today. And I think those numbers would be declining even quicker, more quickly today, because of just how quick society is changing. About 62% of children have a mother who works outside the home, slightly less than those with a father. So that's about even, fathers and mothers working. So definite change in the family structure over the last 50 years or so.
Yeah, and it appears we're not really looking at these changes logically like we should be. We're not understanding how threatening these types of changes are. For example, if we just look at it in a common sense way, doesn't it make sense to have two parents in the home so that at least one of them can go out and work while the other one stays home and watches the children? If that's not happening, what are you doing with those children? Are you putting them in a daycare where who knows what happens? I mean, there are plenty of stories about horrible things happening at daycares, and a mother would not allow her own child to suffer that way in almost every situation. So even there, you see that it makes more sense to have a two-parent household. Then it comes down to who's better at which role or who's more suited for each role. And clearly, the mother is more nurturing. She does have a lot more patience for rearing and developing the child and staying with the child all day. And so it would make more sense if she had that job. And it's an amazing job to raise the next generation, to raise leaders. I mean, that there's no shame in that type of a role whatsoever. And yet society has basically just scorned it relelessly to where now I think a lot of women probably feel ashamed if they're asked what their career is and they said that they're stay-at-home mothers.
That's a really good point. In the attack against fatherhood, probably maybe even a precursor to that was the devaluing of the woman's role, mm-hmm. and the of the wife and the mother, and making that out to be this, you know, not essential. You could ask, I can't say everybody, but I would assume most people that had, you know, solid families, you could ask them, you know, well, is mom important? Yeah, extremely important. But when that role is diminished, then you can attack the fatherhood, and that's what we see happening as well.
Yeah, and you make a good point there about maybe the mothers sort of having that opportunity to leave the home because of, well, at least here, because of world wars and the fact that their husbands were going into the war and the wives had to take their place in the factories and at these other jobs. But what that did was it kind of gave the idea that, well, men and women are the same. We can undergo the same experiences out in the workplace. We can accomplish the same things. And so why should either of us be staying at home when you could just have it either way, or maybe both of us could go out and work? And then it's like, okay, well, if women can do anything men can do, then what's the point of the man's role anyway? At least women feed the child, and, you know, at least they biologically are able to do that. So at that point, what is the value of a man? And so you just see the progression of this attack against both roles.
Yeah, and even the current crisis that we, a crisis or climate, I don't know, I guess it's a crisis of all these women being, you know, sexually harassed and so forth. A lot of that happens in those workplaces.
Right.
That's just the reality of it. I've had various jobs over the years, and I worked at a place, not here, somewhere else, years ago. And it happened in the office. You know, everyone knew what was happening. It was a terrible thing, and a family got broken up because of it. And it all happened because of the office. I mean, because it was, people were together all the time, and bad things happened there. So there's a lot of negative fruits from the family breaking apart. and a lot of misery over the years because of it.
Absolutely. And that book, that really it's a foundational book for learning about the two roles, but Man of Steel and Velvet, in that book, the workplace is described as hard and cold. It doesn't care about comforting and consoling the workers. It's just not an environment that naturally suits the woman as much. And so it is more difficult for a woman to go out in the workplace. Like you mentioned, they can't physically defend themselves as easily. There does become the issue of sexual misconduct when you combine the genders in a lot of cases. And so we keep having problems like this, but we're not getting back to why they're taking place. Why are we having these issues? And it's not that every man is a potential sexual predator. There's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, just some bad situations that can lead to problems. But you bring out a really good point too. I think anybody that's had a good situation where they had a mother that really was outstanding, one of the best feelings is say if you come home from school or later when you get married and everything and you come home from work, it's nice to come home and have a nice home environment, which also takes work to do, of course. But it's a different type of work. But that's as a kid, it's one of the best feelings in the world. You come home from school, it was a rough day at school, mom's there, things are okay, things are taken care of. That's a great, great feeling.
Yeah, so basically, whether you're the husband or the child, you're coming from a hard and cold environment in a lot of cases, almost every case, into a warm, loving, nurturing home environment because of the way that the woman establishes things there. If it's the woman leaving the house, she's going out into that hard, cold environment at work, and then the home environment's not going to be as warm and loving because the man's not as good at that, and so she doesn't really get the love and the comfort that she deserves either whenever you switch the roles like that.
Yeah, it's no fun to come home if there's nobody there for you.
No.
A couple other numbers here that are sort of interesting just to highlight how the family structure has changed. It's unmarried couples, more than 8 million opposite-sex couples live together without being married. And about 38% of those unmarried couples have a child under the age of 18 living with them. So they kind of are sort of a family, but they haven't officially become one. A lot of people living in that situation, too.
Yeah, and that totally undermines the lesson that we all try to tell our children, which is to, be wise with these relationships. Even in public schools, they're trying to tell you to at least use contraception if you're going to engage in sexual intercourse. And yet, what's the point of being careful when you see all types of couples that are living together into their 30s and just living however they please? And maybe marriage seals it at the end, but if you can just sort of have any relationship you want to and break it off at any time, it's not official under a marriage vow and covenant, well, why be as careful anymore either?
Yeah, it's and really you have to think about the kids and the value to the children and having a mother, having a father there in those God-given roles. And it's changing so much in society. There's an article from Fact Tank that says fewer than half of U.S. kids today live in a traditional family, as it were. They've got a picture in the article of, I guess you'd consider it the 1950s, sort of. That kind of is the time period people look at. But fewer than half of the kids today live in that traditional family. So what happens to those kids? See, that's the thing. We always sort of look at these movements as they're happening, and there's all kinds of them today. Everything's breaking apart as far as societal norms, and people get caught up in the moment. But yet, what's it going to be in 10 years if we've got 10 years? Or, you could look back at, say, the 60s and say, well, what did that lead into? Where have we come? There's not enough people really looking at that and saying, is it going in a better direction or is it worse?
Right, and we could both assert the endless benefits of just growing up in that traditional family environment because, in some cases, when I was growing up, we had to help out single fathers and single mothers because obviously they have to go to work. And so my mother was able to watch their children along with us. And that's the sort of environment or the sort of setup that allows for children to be cared for whenever there is a mother who's able to stay at home. And obviously there are situations where that becomes impossible and you just kind of have to have friends and family stepping up. But the benefits to me were clear, and I always wished for any of my friends who did not have that situation that they maybe one day could experience it like I did. And then I even knew some people who grew up in really, really non-traditional type families where I felt very bad for them because, I mean, they don't have the example to strive for. They don't know what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman. They don't understand how to grow up with the right types of character traits or personality traits. And so everything is backward if you don't have that right foundation at home. And it really takes a lot for any individual person to overcome that type of disadvantage.
Yeah, what people don't think about very often is, like, say, the psychologist we quoted in the beginning, is what does it do to the kids? Like, what does it do to the next generation? You know, a person may want to go out and have whatever lifestyle they want, but what is it going to do to, if you have children or if you're hoping to, you know, have some sort of situation like that? What does it do for them? Is it helping them or hurting them? Because if you honestly look at all the societal changes that are away from the biblical model, it's all selfishness. You know, a person doesn't get into bad situations, you know, for the sake of the children. It's all selfish and self-centered, and that's just the truth of it.
Yeah, and a big, I guess, excuse for abortion is that people get into relationships and they can't afford the child that they create. And, well, if the family was married and marriage doesn't come until the man is able to provide for a family, and if you get those things in order, then there's not even an argument for it anymore. I mean, that it just shows you the extremes we can get to, where now it's abortions by convenience, abortions to sort of offset the promiscuous lifestyle that we're living, not getting our lives in order before we start getting into those activities or trying to raise children. I mean, it just shows you there are consequences, and in this case, dire consequences, because a couple thousand babies every day are being killed because of situations like that.
And then this is a really, really amazing statistic in a bad way. More babies are born to unmarried mothers than ever before. Unmarried women accounted for 41% of births in 2011. It's amazing. And that's up from just 5% in 1960. Has the family changed? Absolutely it has. And then that's the whole next generation that's coming along. They break it down by the racial groups, too. In 2011, 72% of births to black women were unmarried, compared to 53% of births to Hispanic, 29% for white women. Those are the numbers.
And the abortion rates are higher based on that as well, because you have to at least commend the women for carrying through and having the child after in those situations. But in a lot of cases, the abortion rates are a lot higher, too, because they don't have a man to support them and allow them to raise the child in an ideal environment. So you just it's so easy to see the right way of doing things, but it's not politically correct to say it. It's not easy to tell somebody that, yes, you have to wait to get married until you're able to financially sustain it, and then you have to wait until you have kids until you have already gotten married, because that is the best environment for the children to grow up in.
Yeah, really amazing numbers, and I just think those highlight, as this book points out, conspiracy against fatherhood, how the family has changed over the years, and really, I guess it'd be the 50 or 60 years. The numbers are really quite amazing and going more and more in that direction. So we're going to get into this booklet more this week and set the stage there with some of the numbers. Something to consider, how much the family has changed in the last few decades and where it continues to go. If it continued to go in this direction, would anyone know what a quote-unquote traditional family, a biblical family is? Would anyone know what a father and a mother should be? There wouldn't be very many, would there?
No, and they wouldn't have any clue the type of happiness they're missing out on.
It's amazing. You got to get this booklet. It's Conspiracy Against Fatherhood, and we're going to go through more of that throughout this week as well. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's coming your way here in just a bit on KPCG, and also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, being Monday, you can listen for Just the Best Literature, a brand new episode and also Music for Life. All of that coming your way here in a bit. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Falk, thanks for being with us, and Grant Turgeon here as well today. And we appreciate you spending some time. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.